Blog Talk Radio.
Rah. Killer Mike Bamboo. You already know. Yeah. No surprise, I'm from a gangbang culture, but we can keep it civil or pull a thang-thang on ya. Southern California where the sun don't quit, intergenerational gang so sons don't quit. But immediately you see that the problems that's in my city are secondary to what's propelling it in my city. I mean really break it down, take poor black and brown, educate them poor, take the jobs from out the town. Then inundate them with the date of drugs and dumb TV, locked into a zoo and hunted daily by the police. Then you get a group of youth who know they don't belong, then they gather up and organize a number up strong. But see, the failure isn't seeing that the problem ain't the gang, it's the situation in the communities where we hang. So I'm so pro-gang, it might scare a motherfucker, cause I fix the misconception that the enemies are brothers.
Bang on the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, upset the setup. Bang on the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, homie, we been set up.
I tell them, I went from a street gang thing, then I joined a military fleet marine force thing. From a little bitty gang in the south of Los Angeles to dragging bodies out of their house to help a government who hell bent on keeping money spent on the missile. The reality's the difference between them shits is little. We had the objective of arming up over money, and they had the objective of arming up over money. And we told kids join us, we the truth. Lies about protecting our block to get recruits. Then we found out we getting killed for a hood, and we don't own a single speck of dirt on that hood. Whether in a zone down south in Decatur, or in a flatlands off of Lenox and La Brea, or in a low-rise project in Chicago, big money come in and buy up our body.
So your sets up, we about to upset the setup.
We about to upset the setup.
Up to upset the setup.
Throw your sets up, we about to upset the setup. Upset the setup.
Up to upset the setup.
I do it for the Crips and the Blooders. BGF Brothers, the real Freeway Ricky Ross and Chris Dutter. I do my thing for Hoover, I represent for Fort. So my folk and my people, so they set to support. Support a mean to Matthew, she might say the shot. So maybe next summer, no mama's gotta cry. Cause maybe next summer, nobody gotta die. Hell, even if we fail, somebody gotta try. The only way the system rule is somebody gotta lie. And the lie they told is old, they base it on your race. They separate you black, you brown, you yellow, and white face. Then we further separate by joining gangs and legislate. That our neighborhoods are now at war like we are separate states. So the police occupy our hood to keep down all the drama. So the Starbucks they just built is comfortable for soccer mama. And American Apparel comfortable for all the hipsters. And it's zero tolerance for all you spicks and you niggas and you chinks and you crackers. And it ain't about who's whiter and it ain't about who's blacker. But the money is a factor, and the factor is the factories got moved up out the hood. When starvation is present and absent is a job, a man will simply starve or he will form a mob. If you should form a mafia, then you should think Sicilian. Buy the hood for real, every block, every field, every field, feed the chill, feed the chill, gang bang, gang bang, build, build, feed the chill, feed the chill, feed the chill, feed the chill, gang bang, gang bang, on the system, on the system.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you
understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over.
Mr. Jackson, sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see to that. Him where it hurts.
Starring Gary Dordan from TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Free the line. Real true ingredients. My name is Food Money Secure. I'm one of your hosts today. I'll be joined by my special host, Conrad Coco. Either you have five goals. Our first goal is to eradicate functional literacy among new African prisoners. Our second goal is to eradicate cultural ignorance from all new African prisons. Our third goal is to transfer the criminal mentality to the new African mentality. And the fourth goal is to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African communities. Our fourth goal, prepare a new African prisoner for release, reduce new African recidivism. You know, our overall goal is transferring the whole pre-industrial slave complex with the prison system into the bigger institutional learning through educational means. Recently, December the 17th, Georgia University Radio commemorated 8 years of service to the people. And on that same day, we commemorated 22 years at Georgia University as an institution itself. You know, I'd like to thank all the people that have been following since 2014. Thank all the people who currently educate themselves in their respective communities and their family and their lifestyles. I thank all the individuals behind enemy lines, all the captured political prisoners, all the captured citizens that are part of New African Independence, the Black Rights Movement, other movements that are currently educating themselves. They will supply information to those individuals that seek it, and also to inspire other individuals through their institutions, their materials, to their writing, to their words, to their conversation, their letters, and so forth and so on, right? Before I bring our co-host on, I'd like to introduce ourselves, then we bring the guests on, I'll let go of a couple of events that happened in history during this week. On December 18th, 1865, the 13th Amendment was ratified, ending more than 200 years of slavery in the United States. In 1946, Steve Biko, leader of the Black Conscious Movement, originate, organized, and active in the struggle in Zaire, South Africa, to get a brutal apartheid system was born. In 1971, Chief United to Serve Humanity Push was founded in Chicago meeting by Reverend Jesse Jackson. On December 19, 1875, Carter G. Woodson, historian, educator, and originator of Black history was born. Sydney Ordinance requiring white and black resident area passed by Baltimore City Council. Similar law was passed in Norfolk, Richmond, Roanoke, Greensboro, St. Louis, Oklahoma City, Dallas, and Louisville. 1930, Jane Weldon Johnson resigned as executive secretary of the NAACP, citing health reasons. December 20, 1852, European settlers defeated by Sotho people in Zaire in South Africa. In 1870, Jefferson F. Long of Macon, Georgia, led it to an uninspired term in the 41st Congress. Also in 1870, Robert H. Wood, a Mississippi political leader, elected mayor of Natchez. In 1949, with the birth of Mustafa Wale L, was represented Imam Malik, a.k.a. Jeff Ford. In 1951, we experienced the birth of Mama Shikari, the widow of the late Qatar Regalder, the architect of Black All Organizing Committee, and a political prisoner. Mama Shikari was a member of the Black Founder Party, working in the Central Committee, and she also a country African citizen. In 1954, Whitney Burris of Mama Benghazi Akinyele, who was a member of the New African People Organization, member of Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, Override Freedom Fire, and an educator. In 1960, represented the birth of Lieutenant Mima of the New African of the Black Legionnaires of the Peter Negro Republic of Africa. And also on that date, we had the birth of Prince Kamasi, the son of Black August historian and Conrad George, Kamasa Gilius. He's also a rapper and a performer, active in the community. December 21st, 1921, PBS Pinchback, major acting in Reconstruction politics, and the first new African governor died in Washington at the age of 84.
December 22nd, 1860, President-elect Lincoln told friend Alexander Stevens of Georgia and other white Southerners they would not interfere directly or indirectly with their slaves and that the white South would be in no more danger in this respect than it was in the days of Washington. In 1898, Chancellor Williams' historian Arthur was born. On December 23rd, 1815, Henry Highland Garnet, minister, abolitionist, and diplomat, was born a slave in Kemp County, Maryland. In 2006, San Francisco and LA, former Panther and grand jury resistor John Bowman died. On December 24th through the 31st, 1881, New Africans from Edgefield County, South Carolina, migrant protesting exploitation and violence settled in Arkansas. You know, those are a couple of events that happened in the week in regards to history. I would like to pass on to my co-host that you interview yourself. We're going to open our line. Okay, go ahead. So your line is open.
Free the land. My name is Sister Coco. As my comrades know me, I'm a conscious new African citizen and worker located in the RNA National Territory. And currently I'm contributing to various nation building efforts, including the support and solidarity of new African political prisoners and POWs, just supporting resistance behind the walls.
Tonight, I'm going to be talking to Mama Gio and Gaza, who's a veteran in the move. I'm going to open up this line to the NC staff. Free the land, Mama.
Free the land.
Free the land. How are you doing tonight?
Better and better. And yourself?
I'm strong. I'm strong, Mama. Before we get into this, tell the people about yourself. Answer yourself. Let them know who you are. So you know exactly what level of expertise and information that you're coming from.
Well, I'm a new African colonized in the USA, founder and director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination and WMXP Community Radio, a member of the Black Belt Human Rights Coalition Criminal Punishment System Subcommittee, a member of the Black Alliance for Peace, and Republican New Africa Planning Committee for the New African Nation Day, 55th anniversary, Charleston, South Carolina, March 2023. I'm a veteran of a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and it was SNCC, the organization that laid the foundation for today's Black Lives Matter movement in its call 1966 for Black Power and declaration that Black is beautiful. As a member of the U.S. Durban 400 delegation, I attended the 2001 Durban World Conference Against Racism, a global gathering, much like the Bandung Conference of the 1950s. From the Durban Conference, the world, indeed governments and civil society, reached a consensus and issued the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, the DDPA. The world declared colonialism, slavery, apartheid, and genocide crimes against humanity. Without having a statute of limitations and as a basis for reparations. We must remember that it was the United States, led by then Secretary of State Colin Powell, that walked out of that August meeting. The USA and other European countries, former colonizers, fought our DDPA efforts then and continue to work to control our movement today, to waylay and to blunt our impact with the racist slur of anti-Semitism. And it's out of that global consensus that the first session of the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent was held in Geneva, Switzerland, December 5th through 8th.
Okay. You know, I understand that the forum had a particular agenda, right? In regard to the opening session, the appointment of different officers, the adoption of the agenda program work, right? Tell a little bit more about what happened during these days during the agenda in regard to, but first off, before you can say something about that, tell us a little bit more about your call to action that you put it out there. Tell a little bit more about that. What actually were you requesting or insinuating or what are your statements that consist of? Tell a little bit more about that in general. Your
Okay, I need you to be louder. I'm not hearing you quite as well. Would you restate your question?
Okay. I said, tell a little bit more about your call to action that you called during the forum, your demand.
Okay. Well, first of all, the forum was of people of African descent from all over the world. You know, we think and we say that we're everywhere. And the fact of the matter is that we are everywhere. And that was one of the affirming and joyous things about the forum was to see and meet African people from all over the world. The only group of African people that was not aware of being present is African people from Australia. But there were African people not only from the continent and from Europe, but from every country in the Western Hemisphere, from Chile, Argentina, Peru, Ecuador, and of course, Cuba. There was some degree of disappointment with regard to Cuba. All the black people in Cuba, they couldn't find one black government representative to send, although there were African people there from Cuba. And there were a lot of young people there, which is a blessing and a curse when you have young people who haven't done their homework and young people who are, as we say, just glad to be there. That can be problematic because it renders them susceptible to manipulation. And since this is significantly more than a school field trip, then it's imperative that folk come prepared to do business without regard for their age. In fact, the United States and the colonizers were had continued their effort to try to control the agenda of the forum and even more important, the global freedom movement, as was evidenced by the Durban Declaration and Program of Action that came out of the 2001 Durban World Conference Against Racism. The forum, as it's presently constituted, is a mechanism designed by the West to waylay, blunt, and bury the Durban Declaration and Program of Action with hand-picked gatekeepers and the racist slur of anti-Semitism. In Durban, as I said a moment ago, the world governments and civil society reached a consensus and issued the DDPA, declaring colonialism, slavery, apartheid, and genocide crimes against humanity without statute of limitations and the basis for reparations. The forum is composed of 10 members, 5 nominated by states or governments, and 5 by the president of the Human Rights Council. Purportedly, the president makes those selections in consultation with civil society. Unfortunately, unlike the representatives for indigenous people, the president is able to make consultation with anyone in civil society as opposed to it being limited to persons of African descent in civil society. The United States described how it pressured governments to vote for its pick, Justin Hanford. Little or nothing else is known about the other's appointment and that process. It is located in Geneva in the office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights instead of the more accessible New York under the more appropriate Economic and Social Council. The chair of the forum is Epsi Campbell Barr, a former vice president of Costa Rica, one of the world's smallest countries and even smaller number of people of African descent. In fact, little more than 400,000, including quote-unquote mixed race. The vice chair is Pastor Elias Murillo Martinez of Colombia, a lawyer with several past government posts. Colombia is second in geographical size to Brazil, with a black population of less than 10%, including quote-unquote mulatto, Roswell, and Pelicano. The rapporteur is a Swede whose name is Michael McEachran. He's mixed race, academic, and activist. As of 2016, there are only 110,758 citizens of African nations living in Sweden. Justin Hanford, the USA member and representative, enjoying the goodwill of the name of Thurgood Marshall, much like Clarence Thomas enjoying the goodwill of Thurgood Marshall's seat. Hansberg is the director of the Howard University Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center. Hansford dismissed the DDPA, saying, "I was only 16 years old when it was written." Of course, he wasn't born when the U.S. Constitution was written, and if he had been, he would have been a slave. He swears by the U.S. Constitution, despite the fact that he uses black liberator language in his presentations. He also reportedly believes he can get a better deal from white folks than the DDPA, or Durban Declaration and Program of Action. I reprimanded him for trying to gaslight me and others when the chair refused to take floor responses to McEachern's attempt to limit the relevance of the Durban Declaration and Program of Action. Forum participants in person and virtually were urged to read the DDPA, as we challenge your listeners to do. We admonished them to not let fancy, obscure language and the lack of information or age or experience and a short-term promise of an immediate bowl of porridge to cause us to betray our peoples. All were challenged to fully claim, affirm, and assert the Durban Declaration and Program of Action as our human right of self-determination. I reminded them that the Durban Declaration and Program of Action is actually the heart and soul of the forum. Without the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, the forum is nothing more than a free trip and a talk fest. The Durban Declaration and Program of Action is our lifeline and that of generations unborn. We must hold on to it. I chanted black power, black is beautiful, black power, all power to the people, and the crowd roared and accepted with a standing ovation. The call for the fidelity and integrity of the DDPA rang out for the remaining 3 days. It is imperative that we here in the United States prepare to maintain the momentum that was built in Geneva in affirmation of the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, study it, and be prepared in for the upcoming meeting in New York in May, the end of May, 1st of June, to continue to demand that it be the center of the forum and any and all other actions that the forum and indeed that comes out of, in our name, permanent forum for people for African descent, and using the last 2 years of the decade for people of African descent to intensify public education and practice, as well as the pillars of the decade of people of African descent.
Okay, that was a lot of information, and it's very informative. I appreciate you updating us and giving us a brief of what's going on. I also recommend that we read the program for action. My question is, how exactly does this forum affect us right here in the empire, such a new African independent movement, Black liberation movement, and other people of color and African descent? How does it affect us in regard to what goes on over there? And also, how can we get involved with it, if it in regard to how it affects us?
Well, let me respond to your last question first. How do we get involved with it? We get involved with it, first of all, by studying it and reading it. There is an effort at this point to organize webinars and study groups of the DDPA, and we will make the information about their availability public as soon as we have been able to complete the organization and set up a schedule. But in the meantime, people can Google the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, and it will come up on your computers and your telephones. That's the first thing. The second thing is at the upcoming meeting for 2023, and it meets annually. The forum meets annually, alternating between Geneva and the United States. So when it's in New York in 2023, then all of us will be able to, or many of us, clearly more of us than who can go to Geneva, will be able to go to the United Nations in New York to participate. So the thing is wherever possible to sign up on the United Nations Office of the Chair of Chair of Human Rights, and I'm getting the OCHR. I'll get it right. Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, to be able to get notices, news notices of events coming up, sponsored and from that office. So that when you see anything that's related to people of African descent, then you can follow through with it. And when it's the forum, there will be a registration process. Registration is free, but like many things today, you have to pre-register in order to be able to attend, and that is the case with this. Now, that's the first thing, two-part answer to participation. And what does it mean in terms of our quantum and quality of life in the United States? It is an other tool that we have to hold the U.S. government, indeed, the global governments accountable for commitments that they make with regard to the quantum and quality of life of people of African descent. It is like the U.S. Constitution in the sense that we can say, based on what you say, this is what you're responsible for doing. As Martin Luther King once said, we're not asking you to do anything special. We're just asking you to do what you said on. So it establishes a baseline for conduct that we have a right to expect and to hold the U.S. government accountable for. That's one part. Another part, which may be even more important, is that it gives us a space and an opportunity to be in contact, communication, and a basis to work with African people all over the world and to reestablish the global African nation, to also reclaim our position in global politics and in the human family across the board. that is one of the aspects of the forum that I think that, and a reason why the Durban Declaration of Program of Action is viewed as being so dangerous is because despite whatever differences we might have, people from all over the world, oppressed people from all over the world, were able to get together and not just reach an agreement, but to reach a consensus. A consensus is very important. The difference between a simple agreement and a consensus is that the spirit as well as the letter of the agreement is what folk have committed themselves to philosophically, spiritually, politically. And in that, the Africans from the U.S. in the Durban 400, led by Brother Roger Wareham of the December 12th movement, was able to lead and to successfully propound the component with regard to reparations, that reparations are due, past due, in fact. Other members of the African, global African community assumed responsibility for various other components of the Durban Declaration and Program of Action. So it gives us another tool. And perhaps more important than anything else is that it gives us an opportunity to rebuild our community as a global people. I would also say that it gives us a yardstick by which to measure other attempts by the West, by pan-Europeans to divide and conquer, to attempt to take advantage of the underdevelopment of various segments of our community. For instance, we see recently the president of, I believe it was Norway, it may have been the Netherlands, but one of the Nordic countries issuing an apology for the colonization of various, in fact, it was Dutch, so it was Denmark, I guess. For enslaving African people in Suriname and in other Dutch colonies, but starting off saying that there was no reparations, wasn't even willing to discuss reparations. We see in the same week the Germans beginning the process of returning to Nigeria the Benin bronzes that were stolen over 100 years ago when they invaded the Nigeria. But at the same time, are also not talking about reparations, and they're not talking about addressing the massacre of, I believe it's the Nomo people of Namibia, who were massacred during colonization. So the fact that we have the Durban Declaration and Program of Action gives all of us a baseline to which to hold the colonizers and to hold the West, including the United States, as to what the debt is that they owe us. We saw what recently what some folk, and I think appropriately, call the meeting of the Uncle Tom, the Uncle Toms meet Uncle Sam, the so-called the summit of African leaders who met with Joe Biden in Washington last week. If my memory serves me correctly, it may have been a few days before that, wherein, as one sister pointed out, unlike when African leadership or when any organization of equals, when mutual respect have a meeting, they create a mutually defined agenda. Instead of the United States working with leaders, the hand-picked leaders, because they didn't invite all the African leaders. They had their particular ones that where they have military bases or they're planning to have military bases in order to be able to fight China and Russia, who bring humanitarian aid while the United States only brings war and death. The system pointed out that the United States imposed its own agenda on the meeting. No consultation, not even a prior announcement of the agenda of the meeting, so that the African present would have an opportunity to develop their own thinking individually or collectively as to how they wanted to deal with the various issues including the sale of U.S. weapons, which of course is a big part of what it was about, U.S. weapons to African armies, and the countries that they didn't invite are countries where the U.S. had unsuccessfully attempted to overthrow the government for the most part. The other thing that the meeting was about was the United States imposing on African countries U.S. corporations in order to attempt to control the natural resources. We know that there's certain resources in Africa that are necessary for modern day technologies. There's the coltan in the Congo, where there's been a war going on for years, where millions of people have been murdered, and we hear all kinds of everything about Ukraine, but nothing about the war going on in the Congo for European countries to control the resources in that country, which is one of the richest countries on the planet. We, the United States, is making drone warfare against countries in the Sahel, the eastern part of the United States. We hear nothing about the drone warfare that the United States is waging. 11 people were murdered by the United States drones in, I believe it was Ethiopia. But we didn't hear anything about that on the news, although we can't turn on the radio or the television to hear about how bad Russia is beating up on the Ukrainians. Well, I would urge people to think back about when the United States invaded Iraq. You know, before the United States actually invaded Iraq, For 30 consecutive nights, the United States bombed that country in the middle of the night, all different times. I had the opportunity to go to Iraq and to meet with civil society, government representatives, and specialists. And I was particularly moved by the psychiatrist who talked about the impact that that 30-day bombing in the middle of the night causing people to be sleep deprived, who that traumatized not only the adults but to terrorize the children, and how to that to this day they still are impacted and affected as a result of that trauma. That the United States blew up the civilian facility, blew up the electric grid, blew up the water treatment facility. So when you hear them complaining about Russia doing the very same thing, remember, just say to yourself, sounds like the United States to me. So let's not get it twisted. War is war, and the greatest casualties in all wars are civilians, most specifically the old, the women, and the children. So the fact of the matter is that we have to be informed. We can no longer simply go along to get along, but we must challenge especially white power in blackface. And Justin Hansford must be challenged. He was very disrespectful to me, and I want people to call him at Howard University Law School and inform him that in our culture, we respect our elders. We respect our elders.
Indeed. I have a question. I have to see on the agenda where in section six, with up on the letter, it talks about race discrimination, reparatory justice, equality for all in the draft, right? What exactly does the equality for all mean when it came to the forum? What exactly did it mean? What were we discussing on that time? What exactly did that mean?
Well, you know, equality for all, I think, in some senses, changes with the circumstances. You know, whether you're talking about equality and capitalism, which capitalism doesn't tolerate equality. You know, capitalism is competitive as opposed to socialism, which is cooperative. So what winds up being equality for all, one, has to be defined by the people. You know, equality may mean that everybody gets a house, but they don't get the house. Everybody don't get the same size house. You know, a single person don't get a three-bedroom house. They may just get a studio apartment. You know, it's based on what you need. It's there's a saying, if I can remember correctly, to each according to his need and from his, her need, and from each according to his or her ability. So there's lately there's more talk about equity than it is about equality, because it has more to do with what are the circumstances than what is the material appearance of things.
Okay. My next question is, when they mentioned reparatory justice, were they referring to reparations, or was it just a little bit more in depth than that? What exactly were they referring to?
Yes, reparations. And actually, reparatory justice must be not only reparatory, but it must be transformative, especially as it relates to us. You know, I mean, you can't repair the damage and loss that we have experienced and that people of African descent around the world have experienced without it being transformative, without it being curative. And what it is for each of us, again, varies depending on what our specific circumstances are. What is reparative and transformative for an African on the continent who knows his or her people is different from what is reparative and transformative for an African in the U.S., where we are like kidnapped, abused children suffering with Stockholm syndrome. We need a lot more. Pardon?
I said we love captivity. We love the captain.
Exactly. We need a whole another set of fundamentals before we even begin to get to the point that we're on the same level as our brothers and sisters on the continent.
Okay. I have one more question, then I'm going to pass it on to my co-host. On the same section, it talks about race discrimination, inequality, and challenges to sustainable development. But what type of development are you talking about, and what are some of the discriminations and inequalities that are being suffered? Is this something that he's talking about globally, or is something that is African country play at a time, or what exactly is that? What are they talking about when it comes to that section?
The Sustainable Development Goals are a set of goals that was passed by the UN General Assembly that all countries are supposed to be working towards. There are some folks who were at the forum who, let me back up and say two things. One is that there are some of us who view the forum, the treatment of the forum by the West as an effort to substitute it, the forum, for the Durban Declaration. We have to resist that. That's what the big fight was about at the first session. And Michael McCutcheon, the Swede, had the audacity to say that Durban Declaration and Program of Action would be applied to the forum to the quote-unquote extent it applied to African people. Well, the fact of the matter is that the Durban Declaration and Program of Action applies to, all of it applies to African people. It is inalienable, it is intersected, and it's universal. So that game that he came up with, there's some other people who are going to challenge him who are in the process of working on an open letter to him and to the commissioner, High Commissioner on Human Rights, to point out that no, it is not, he's not going to get to decide to pick and choose what of our agreement, what of our consensus he, as boss of the forum, as he's presenting himself to be, to decide. The second thing is that there were other people at the forum who viewed the sustainable development goals as an easier way of getting the West, getting European and U.S. other former colonizer governments to agree to do basically affirmative action on those sustainable goals. For instance, ending poverty is one of the sustainable goals. In fact, if my memory serves me correctly, it's the first one. So that any efforts or programs that they would engage to end poverty would have an affirmative action component that would focus on people of African descent. Well, we know that that's not going to go anywhere. We've been through affirmative action in the United States since its inception, and it's only been in the past, 40 years that we've had affirmative action for black people and white women, and the U.S. Supreme Court is about to do away with that. So the while the sustainable goals are a good idea, the likelihood that it's going to solve the problems of people of African descent is minimal to nil. There are others, and again, that the use of the sustainable goals as a standard as opposed to the DDPA, Durban Declaration and Program of Action, would be an easier take. I don't know whether young brother Justin Hansford is of that school of thought, and that's what he thinks would be a better deal, quote unquote better deal, or not. But it is certainly not. And if he thinks that affirmative action in the United States is going to be revived, he hasn't been paying any attention. Director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Institute or not.
Okay. I appreciate the information. I appreciate you coming by broadcast so you know how you understand it. And I appreciate the work you're going to do to pass prison in the future. I'm going to say free the land. I'm going to pass our co-host, Ms. Coco, so she can continue to take the show through. Your line is open, so go ahead.
Free the land. I really just wanted to say it's really great to be here tonight to have this discussion with you, Mama Afia, and Brother Bomani. So, like, my first question, I did have the opportunity to review the Durban Declaration. And so so my question is, can one conclude that although this declaration exists, right, there's still this neo-colonial, neoliberal established power, right, that has kind of adjusted itself, right, to undermine and distract new African struggles for self-determination by promoting this idea of diversity and intersectional identity tactics, right, that that would seem to support this declaration and its proposed intent. So what would your response be to that, as, you know, this idea that, you know, racial discrimination and, you know, this, you know, the colonial oppressor has, you know, obviously created so much destruction in the world, right, and across, you know, across the globe, various nations. And so when thinking about, like, these ideas of multiculturalism and diversity and these tactics that the oppressor has seemed to, I guess, you know, learn how to adapt, right, and to use it in their favor. So my question to you is, how can we, you know, kind of think through these ideas of, you know, of tactics that would kind of undermine self-determination for, you know, New African nation?
Well, it's my honor and my privilege to be in conversation with you all and your listeners. And before I forget it, I want to thank those of you who donated to help to cover the costs of my being able to go to Geneva. We can't expect the enemy to finance the revolution. So unless and until we are, in fact, to assume that responsibility to prioritize that, then our own struggle, then it's not going to happen. And that is a part of my response to your question, sister. Durban Declaration and Program of Action is an expression of self-determination, and that is one of the reasons why it is so important that we not allow it to be discounted and dismissed and buried, because it is an agreement that we have made with ourselves, among ourselves, and to ourselves throughout the world. So we must not allow anyone or anything to take that away. Now, we may, on reflection, we meaning the parties to the consensus, may say we have reviewed it and we want to change this or we want to change that. But it's us who get to do that and not our enemies and certainly not outside parties. That is the first thing. The second thing is that there are definitions within the Declaration and the Program of Action that spell out what must be done. So our job is to make sure that those things are done. And in the process of making sure that those events occur, including using this last 2 years of the decade of people of African descent, making it meaningful. There are people who are asking for a second decade as an extension, whether that's going to happen or not, and if it did, whether it's going to matter is another matter. Is another question. But the question is are we committed to the decisions that we make, and are we prepared to make the investments necessary in order to realize them? It's not up to our enemies to decide what the definition. He who defines the terms is the master. And if we're going to be the master of our own fate, then it is we who must make those definitions and hold to them. In fact, there was, I believe it was Baba Amos Wilson, who used to say that power is the ability to define a term and have others to accept it as their own. We have got to exercise Black power. Black power is more than just a slogan. It's a way of life. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of operating.
I definitely appreciate your response. And thinking about that and this idea that this declaration or this notion that this declaration is a right to self-determination, it declares the right to self-determination. But it seems as though the United States continues to be in violation, right? And so holding the United States accountable, holding the United States accountable to these declarations, what as a new African nation, as people who are looking for who are struggling for the right to be self-determined, for land and independence, and obviously it does, you know, speak to this in the declaration as far as the Atlantic slave trade and the impact of that. So how would we think in terms of as a nation to hold the United States accountable to their lack of their continued genocide, right, against African people here in the United States and the Americas? What would that look like for the new African nation in your eyes?
I think that in my personal eyes, I think that we have seen what that looks like, and that is that we have people who have engaged and built self-defense. I think and under international law, oppressed people have the right to resist. Not only do we have the right, human right to resist, but we have the human right of self-defense. And the question becomes, to what extent are we prepared to exercise those rights and to pay the price for exercising under the circumstances that we find ourselves at this point in time? You know, when we say freedom or death, it's more than a slogan. So we make the decision about the price that we're going to pay and the extent to which we're going to be free. Somebody, I'm trying to remember who it was, is a quotation. I like to do attribution, although my memory is beginning to fail me. It says something to the extent of that you'll know just how oppressed the people will be, as indicated by how much punishment they'll take. And I'm paraphrasing that. You know, when Frederick Douglass decided that he wasn't going to take any more abuse, he fought back, and then he left. There's someone else, maybe it was Denmark Vesey, who said he who would be free must strike the first blow. Now, that doesn't always mean physical force. You know, we've got more than brawn. We've got brains as well. So question again becomes, how committed are we to being free, and what price are we willing to pay? It was interesting in one of the side events that was organized. It was a side event organized on the importance of the DDPA, the Durban Declaration and Program of Action. And there were a number of people there who were expressing concern that there were quote-unquote powerful nations, meaning the United States and Canada and Britain, Germany and France, who are opposed to the DDPA, and they have made no secret of it. In fact, Justin Hansford has been specifically told that the United States does not support the DDPA, and even though he talks about himself being about the liberation of African people, he's prepared to dump it because he was only 16, so he says, and he thinks he can get a better deal, so he says. without regard for the work that went into getting it and the fact that we are the only people who have to start from square one, from one generation to the next. We're not accepting that. We're going to break that cycle. I reminded them, you know, the Vietnamese, that tiny little country, brought the United States to its knees. And if the truth be told, the United States did not win in either Iraq nor Afghanistan. So, you know, it's a constant protracted struggle that begins in the minds and hearts of the people. And those of us who claim to be committed to the liberation and freedom and the nation building of our people, it begins with us. And what is it that we're willing to do to be consistent in what we say and what we do?
Indeed, I agree. We definitely need to have some consistency and be engaged, especially in a forum or, you know, an international forum such as these. And so my next question in regards to the Durban Declaration, how can we translate that to our captive citizens and political prisoners and POWs who are typically held captive because of these racial discrimination and suppression of certain political beliefs that for people who do believe that they are entitled to sovereignty and entitled to build a nation based on the fact that the United States has historically discriminated against people of African descent? What would this declaration, how important would this declaration be to those people who are held currently captive in the largest incarcerated and penal system in the world?
The Durban Declaration and Program of Action requires in the forum, in the, through the forum, for our purposes, requires interaction with the various other mechanisms and treaties to which the United States and other countries are parties. And the United States is a party to four treaties: the International Covenant for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, there's the ICCPR, which is the International Covenant for Political and International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, UPR, Universal Periodic Review, and the CAT, the Convention Against Torture. The third and I have done reports, stakeholder or shadow reports, as they're called, evaluating the United States on all of those, the four of those, as it relates to political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles. When I did the campaign from 2010 to 2016 to put U.S. Political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles on the global human rights agenda, and it was the first such time that that was done. As a result of that, the United States was directed, I would say more accurately, it was recommended and or suggested that the United States perform or meet certain tasks in order to come into compliance with its obligations under those treaties. And the language, the diplomatic language is to recommend or to suggest as opposed to demand or direct. Since all of the members of the UN are theoretically on equal footing and don't have any authority to make demands on one another. And in each of those instances of review, the United States was called upon to address political prisoners, prisoners of war and exile, and the conditions of, as I coined the phrase, imprisoned COINTELPRO civil rights era human rights defenders and activists. Not using the term, the specific terms, political prisoner, prisoner of war, and exiles, given their legal language in international, the legal meaning in international law and their significance, political significance under various circumstances. And of course, the United States' position is, articulated position is that it doesn't have political prisoners, but all governments, not just the United States, all governments deny the existence of political prisoners. They call them criminals, that they criminalize political activity, and therefore, the under the Universal Periodic Review, Cuba, Venezuela, and Iran called on the United States to release all political prisoners. At that time, the Cuban Five were being held in captivity in the United States, so they named Cuba, since Cuba actually wrote out its demands, Venezuela and Iran stating them from the floor rather than writing them out. Cuba called for the release of the Cuban Five, the release of Leonard Peltier and Mamia Abu-Jamal, and of all other political prisoners and persons held incarcerated for political activities. That was historic. That occurred. That was the first time that that ever happened, to put that on the official record of the United Nations. That report was done by Standish Willis of the National Conference of Black Lawyers and myself. Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. I raised political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles as having been prosecuted for resisting the racist genocidal practices of the United States. And in the official report coming out of that Human Rights Committee, called on the United States to not only release them, but to also to report back at its next reporting period, which was 5 years from the point at which I made the report, and that the committee responded, that they would report back to the committee as to what they were going to do to release those people and to compensate them, and generally and more specifically, the release of the Angola Three, who, of course, as we know, was since released, and at least one, if not two, have transitioned. With regard to the ICCPR, the International Covenant for Political and Civil Rights, civil and political rights. My apologies. It's easier for me to remember the letters than the language itself, but I know you all don't know the letters, so I'm trying to give you both of them so you can appreciate the essence of the treaties. We had, I raised the same issues because all of my reviews were on behalf of political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles. You know, we don't often include exiles in our calls for justice because we think that simply because someone appears to be at liberty, that they are free, that they are not subject to the pain of incarceration. But the truth of the matter is that they are. The tether is not as tight, but it is as strong. We argued that we had a right to resist, and in exercising that right to resist, then which included self-defense, then to lock people up was a violation of our use of our right of self-defense. And so there were a number of clauses in the ICCPR that the United States was called upon to comply. Paragraph 16 of the ICCPR, and you can look that up, is one of the specific paragraphs that was applied. CAT, the Convention Against Torture, in light of the fact that our political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles are often, invariably, in fact, given longer sentences and held in harsher conditions, constitutes a form of torture. Specifically, when they and anyone else, for that matter, is held in solitary confinement for more than 15 days. And, of course, we have political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles who are isolated for years, which is a clear violation. Now, one of the strengths of the UN is what they call naming, blaming, and shaming in the court of public opinion. And it is generally felt, and I think that this is a moment similar to the late 40s and 50s, where African countries were gaining their independence and the United States was courting them, as it is today, attempting to get them to turn against Russia and China. The United States had to show how it was treating the Africans in its own borders, how it was treating us. And, of course, that was during the days of great segregation, Jim Crow, and lynch mobs. So in order to say to Africans on the continent who were gaining at least flag independence that they should look favorably on the United States as they want them to do now, the United States wants to be what they call their preferential trade partner above China and Russia, then they had to do things that were going to give the impression that the quantum and quality of our life was being changed. And therefore you had then President Dwight Eisenhower sending troops to Little Rock, Arkansas to desegregate the schools. Or you had the FBI at least in theory, going to look for the three civil rights workers who were murdered in Mississippi, even though nobody went to jail over it. So today we have a forum. We have an opportunity to have that conversation, that global conversation with other people of African descent and say, no, 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 no. They're still doing it. So we need you to still put the pressure on them to do differently, to behave differently. And because the United States wants something from them, if they are in community with us, can make that demand for us or support us in making that demand, then we have some lever of power, at least publicly, in the court of public opinion. So there's a spectrum of tools that are available, and it's a question of our imagination and our commitment and our willingness to invest and to use them. And if I didn't say it, imagination.
Yes, imagination is definitely important. And I appreciate leading up to this idea that, you know, we have to engage, right? We have to be present and participatory when it comes down to engaging an international audience, right? And getting other sovereign nations to recognize, right, the resistance and the right to self-determination here for new Africans that are under, you know, colonized colonial rule in the United States. So because of that, a lot of times, you know, depending on however people choose to organize themselves here in the United States, most often than not, most people consider themselves citizens and therefore have considered themselves have a right to rights under the United States Constitution. But how does the Durban Declaration help to support new Africans who seek sovereignty, right? How does this declaration support new Africans in thinking and in terms of, you know, self-governance, right? Like what does self-governance, how does help self-governance help to support new Africans in their struggle here, but help to kind of separate this idea that the United States is responsible for our lives, right? This that they have this right to determine for us, right, how they're going to respond to our conditions, right? So rather than allowing the United States to respond to our conditions, being self-governing in the, you know, as new Africans could potentially alleviate some of those issues where the United States or, you know, the oppressor nation typically goes into communities and decides for us how they're going to tackle racial discrimination, right? And obviously the forum that you were at is representative by people who don't have our best interests, right? So how would you think in terms of that, of like how people should be organizing and thinking in terms of self-governance versus inclusion into a system that doesn't necessarily, you know, is in violation of a lot of these declarations?
Two things. First of all, I would remind you that the Durban Declaration and Program of Action specifically states that colonialism, slavery, apartheid, and genocide are crimes against humanity. That's the first thing. The second thing is that there are provisions in the Durban Declaration that addresses the issue of decolonization. So the question is whether or not we are going to study and apply that process. excuse me, there are other mechanisms that interface with the Durban Declaration that deal with the issue of decolonization. Again, however, I would go back to the point that I made earlier and say that the first step to decolonization is in the hearts and minds of the people, in our individual hearts and minds, not what somebody down the street is doing or not doing, but what is it that we are doing that manifests our recognition of our colonial status and our effort to resist and to function as independent and sovereign persons, and individually and collectively. So there's work that's going on a number of levels at the same time. And a part of that, again, goes back to the question of the price to be paid. Now, obviously, as a part of reparations, decolonization would be an element. However, do we wait until we have won reparations and that the part of the transformation of the reparatory judgment is decolonization? That's a decision that we have to make individually and collectively, that we make, not they make, we make. And I think that that's one of the most difficult, the greatest difficulty that we have is believing that we really have a right to make decisions about our own lives.
Indeed, that last statement definitely has me inspired to continue this work, because we should have the want and the willpower to determine for ourselves what we want, considering the history, especially considering the history and the economic, social impact that it has had on our people. I don't know if we want to open it up for any comments, any callers that are on the line.
Free land. Yeah, hold on. I want to open up. Open a line to our founder, Aditya. You let him have, and let him speak a few words right quick. Connor, your line is open. If you have anything to say, you want to say something. Abdul, your line is open, Connor. You got anything you want to say?
Come on, comrades. Let's give me some feedback.
Hey, hold on. I'm trying to see. 90192. Yeah, you got a question, comment, statement. Go ahead. Free land.
Free the land, Comrade Bomani, Sister Coco, and Mama Effia. This is Mama Ayo.
Free the land.
Go ahead,
by any means necessary.
Yeah.
Free the land. Free the land. It was a wonderful program tonight. A lot of information. I have lots of notes. I have a lot of questions, but let me just ask a couple. You talked about the crimes against humanity, of course, You talked about colonialism, chattel slavery, genocide, etc. Was the question of neocolonialism addressed? Because that's where we are in this stage of history. Practically everybody has supposedly, in theory, become independent, including New Africans, so-called emancipation, Juneteenth, etc. Mm-hmm. So we are, at this particular point in our history, neocolonial captive citizens. And so when you put us on the world stage, the gathering of nations and organizations, most of the people that met with Biden are neocolonial puppets. Neocolonial mm-hmm. puppets, and we know because of aid, because of the military, because of the inequity that happens with them, with nations taking raw materials out of their countries. So when we talk about the world gathering, and holding these enslavers, because that's who they were, enslavers and mm-hmm. captors, mm-hmm. accountable, you don't have a lot of leaders in government today. And that's across the board, because the leaders that do stand up against neocolonialism, imperialism, because even imperialism, you didn't, that term was not mentioned. Come to a consensus when most of our leaders in Africa, in the Caribbean, except a few, there are a few instances, are in the pockets of their former colonial masters? That's my first question.
Okay, the two things that come to mind, first of all, and that is the beauty of the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, that despite the efforts of the enslavers to defeat the building of a consensus was reached. And that's one of the reasons that it must be preserved. The integrity of it must be preserved, that we could come together and reach a consensus. And you know what a consensus is. That means nobody disagreed, nobody blocked, nobody withdrew, no abstentions. That was transformative in and of itself, to be able to do that. I went back and I looked at the Bandung Conference and the outcome of the Bandung Conference and how the enslavers were able to break up the unity that came out of the Bandung Conference, even though you had the non-aligned nations to come to some, to take some formation. It wasn't a strong formation, and they were able eventually to just destroy it. Today, the United States is having a problem getting even the neo-colonial leadership that it trotted out last week or 2 weeks ago to take a position with the United States against Russia on Ukraine. That's why they had the meeting. Mm-hmm. That's why the United States called the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
So our people are not, we're no longer in a unipolar world. We're no longer in a world, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the big dog was the United States by itself.
Right.
But that's no longer the case. You got mm-hmm. Russia and you got China. So, there's some room to maneuver there. And these people are saying, we don't have a dog in that fight, and we ain't cutting off our nose despite our face to suit you. They're saying that. There is no uh-huh. African country that is going along with the United States, they're saying we're neutral. Now, there's some of them, you know, they got them U.S. bases with AFRICOM, but they ain't coming out against Russia or China and favor the United States on Ukraine or anything else, actually, for that matter. And that's not to say that Russia and China's hands are clean, but they ain't bowing down to the United States. That's number one. Or number two.
Number three is
colonialism. I don't recall any specific reference to neocolonialism, but I don't think that we should get caught up in, and I don't want to minimize it by saying splitting hairs, I don't think that we should allow ourselves to get distracted by by the nuances of language. That's the word I'm looking for. You know, either you're colonized or you ain't.
Yeah,
and it doesn't.
Exactly.
If you got white power in blackface, it's still colonial. So it's still a crime against humanity, to even when they use agents to perpetuate their will, to impose their will. And
gotcha.
You know, I mean, when I think about the Congo, it just makes me sick. And when I think about Kigali of Rwanda,
exactly.
You know, so No, well, I think we can't afford to yield to nuances. It's one or the other. Either it's independent. That's why I said flag independence.
Absolutely. My next question is, what do you feel is the role, if there is any longer, because we definitely have the Durban Conference of 2001. What's the role of the African Union? What do you see as their role in playing an important part?
You know, I think that, you know, with the loss of Gaddafi, the African Union has, you know, falls on the same ground as the United Nations. Excuse me, and that is that it's dependent on the West for its money. And
exactly.
He, the piper calls the tune. So I think that It's interesting. I haven't paid enough attention to the decisions that it's made and the positions that it's taken. But I do know that China has been very supportive of it. And in fact, that it was China who built the headquarters of the African Union. So it's going to be interesting to see how it's going to, as they say, thread the needle between the U.S. and the West, the white countries, and Russia and the and China. There is a sister, and her name African or something. I was reading about her yesterday, who was
Arikana.
The U.S. ambassador to the African Union,
yeah.
Who and if it's anybody knows her name, I'd appreciate the help.
Arikana.
Who?
I know her. One of her names is Arikana.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, exactly. And that they wound up getting rid of her, which I thought was a year before last. And they did it in a really rude and harsh way, disrespectful. But it didn't silence her. So I think that I think they're still trying to figure out who they are and where their loyalties are going to wind up being, and how they're going to be able to function in a way that they're still going to be able to give white folks money, and how they're going to serve two masters. So
that's correct.
That's about all I can say about them at this. My thinking is about them at this point.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. But my final question, of course, would be: we consider ourselves to be nationalist Pan-African freedom fighters as part of the New African Independence Movement, and one of our tasks is to implement, of course, the 8 strategic elements, where we look at our alliances with, of course, Black nationalists, and then also the Pan-Africanists. So I am in total agreement, and of course with our reparations, because reparations is key for the establishment of the Republic of New Africa. Our claim to reparations are holding not only Britain but Spain, whoever was on this landmass, whoever enslaved Africans, accountable for crimes against humanity. And our reparations claim is from the standpoint of the Republic of New Africa, not only does it have to have a nationalistic agenda, but also to support reparations that comes from the African world, the meeting in New York going to be moving forward the claims of reparations, not only just for the descendants of enslaved Africans here, but also abroad. The diaspora Africa. Yes.
It's global. All Africans.
Yes.
All people
okay.
of African
Great.
Descent.
Okay.
All people of African okay. descent. And the thing is being able is again us being able to come together and take the reparations element of the DDPA to the next level. So what does that wind up looking like in this day and time where, to talk about reparations and demand reparations is not some wild-eyed, crazy, extremist idea anymore, it's socially acceptable politics to demand it. So we have in various countries and regions folks making demands. You got CARICOM in the Caribbean, where they've the governments have gotten together and created a commission, and they're leaning on the UK. You've got, where the president made the apology, the people accepted the apology, but they said, well, we still want reparations. So
exactly.
There are individual claims that are emerging at this point in time. There are at the same time other theories, a global theory of reparation coming out, coming up out of a combination of that the trafficking and enslavement of African people was a global phenomenon and therefore it should be a global demand. I'm not sure about that. You know, we need to talk more about that. And then you have another reparation demand emerging out of climate change.
Exactly.
And in the COP27, they came up with this principle of law, damage and loss. So, you know, what does that mean in terms of reparations? And we know for the Holocaust of enslavement, and we know that Africa, and actually the diaspora in some places, has had tremendous suffering as a result of climate change, the droughts and mm-hmm. famines in Africa mm-hmm. and the floods on the islands and of our people who are in various countries, say in South America, where they are on the coast and the ocean is rising and therefore they're being affected. So there's another aspect of reparations that's emerging.
Pause up, Mama Celia. Well, we got like 5 minutes left. Can you give your final thoughts?
My final thoughts is let's start putting our pennies together so that we are prepared to go to New York the last week of May, the first week of June. I believe it's May 29th through June 2nd or 3rd, but the date will come up. And that we should, all of us, go online and start reading the Durban Declaration and Program of Action and these UN mechanisms so that we are informed and prepared to use them to our advantage.
Okay. I appreciate that. So, Coco, you got any final? What are your final thoughts?
Hey, Delan. I definitely just wanted to say I appreciate Mama Fia for coming onto the show.
Can we put this back?
Yes, hold on, please. And also, Mama Ayo, I really appreciate your question. Definitely gave me also a lot to think on when it comes down to thinking in terms of this Durban Declaration. So I'll definitely be studying and working through some of the things that I've read in Ayo.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I want to thank Mama Fia for the work that she's been committing in the past, present, and what she's doing in the future right now. I don't think I can share that with understanding. If you have any loved one, comrade, social behind enemy lines, please look at the George Jackson University. We find on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or you contact us directly while the website being rebuilt. Contact us directly by emailing us at georgejackson71@gmail.com. Again, George Jackson University, 71@gmail.com. Long live the resistance, long live the African independent movement, and free the land.
By any means necessary.